when we have to reconstruct a possible lacking object or role or function, we can see that if the analyst in itself has been able, and the patient allowing him to be able to enter to a deep level the objectal reality of the internal world of the patient, it can happen that some new function or position can be installed, can be achieved. And this is something that could be rare, in fact. But it happens. And this is one more reason for not blaming the length of some analysis, some analytic treatments, because time is needed for reaching, for entering that internal deep area where the analytic relation can create something new. Transformation is also one of the words that in our analytic world became more and more common and utilized fruitfully, because we have achieved the certainty that there can be a transformation, not only an understanding or a clarification, but also a transformation of the quality of the objectal world and of the relation with it.
Welcome to the IPA podcast, Psychoanalysis on and off the couch. This podcast consists of conversations with psychoanalysts from around the world who share with us their clinical and psychoanalytic work with individuals both on and off the couch. And what we mean by off the couch is that they share with us their community involvement in many different venues apart from their consultation rooms. They describe their work in hospitals, in community clinics, in refugee centers, in classrooms, indeed in war zones. We also have conversations with psychoanalysts who are focusing their work on the couch, and they are continuing to refine both our familiar and novel understandings of the dynamic mind as it presents itself in the analytic situation. Please visit our website, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can subscribe, where you can see the recommended readings provided by our guests, and you can also leave a comment. I hope you enjoy these conversations and find them thoughtful and meaningful, and I appreciate your listening. Thank you. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz, and my guest today is Dr. Stefano Bolognini, and we have a conversation around his book, Freud and the Changing World, with a subtitle of Contemporary Psychoanalysis and Its Troubles. And the book consists of a conversation he had with an Italian psychoanalyst colleague of his, Luca Nicolai. And we select aspects of his thinking and the conversation to elaborate, which basically covers his sense of the way patients are different now, which is something we've discussed in an earlier podcast, the link of which will be on these show notes. But even further than that, it's about how our field has changed in relation to these changes in the culture and in the patients before us. He gives many examples of how the culture has changed. It's all about the direction of what he feels is a narcissistic focus on the self, which changes initial presentations. For example, patients often come in concerned with how they imagine they appear in others' eyes, as opposed to in the past, people came in feeling guilty about something or having imaginings that frightened them. And we discuss how the changes are real, how the changes are themselves to avoid more traditional conflicts around guilt, and also how he associates it with various child rearing practices that have evolved over time in terms of family support, and also what he feels is a premature rupture of the maternal-infant bond, so that the infant isn't brought up bathed in a sense of dependability and security, which shows up later in our offices. Even insofar as how one introduces the idea of entering an analysis, he feels is changed nowadays from what it was then. We talk about many other matters, his understanding of how in the world of sexual diversities now, he certainly doesn't bring a moralistic stance to it. He brings a scientific stance, which is, how do we understand the nature and the depth of the object relations that underline the sexual diversities? There's much more we discuss, and he closes by reading the last page of the book. You can hear me smiling as I describe this, because he didn't know that he quotes his analyst, and that was an analysis that took place many, many decades ago. But he both begins and ends his book with an homage to his analyst, and we reflect on what that, how that lives for him. It's a fascinating conversation. Dr. Bolognini is a well-known person. He was the head of the International Psychoanalytic Association. He trained as a psychiatrist. He is a training and supervising analyst at the Italian Psychoanalytic Society. He was an IPA board member. He was a he's written over 280 psychoanalytic papers, and his books on empathy and the interpsychic dimension have been translated into several languages. As last time, I find my conversation with Stefano really a delight, and I hope you enjoy it as well. Stefano, welcome back to the podcast. It's so good to have you. This is our second conversation, and the first one was about a chapter that you wrote in a book, and it was about what you felt were the different qualities of patients that come to analyst's office today. And you've expanded that in a book that we're going to focus on today, and your book is called Freud and the Changing World, with a subtitle of Contemporary Psychoanalysis and Its Troubles. And this is a book where you are interviewed by an Italian analyst colleague, Luca Nicolai. And I would draw the listeners and potential readers' attention to a marvelous image of Freud on the front cover, which was designed and created with the help of Luca Nicolai's brother. And it's an updated version of Freud. It's a little severe, but it's sort of hip at the same time. And it's a wonderful characterization of the theme of the book. I want to jump right in. I want to read from the first paragraph of the book on page one, and I'm going to ask you to elaborate. You write, "The exploration of the unconscious today is done with the patient, whilst in the past it was more about the patient." And you go on to say, "For a long time, the analyst saw him or herself as a mirror who had to do and say as little as possible. Whereas today we take it for granted that the process is more complex and that the analyst, however reserved and abstinent, also does something, whether he or she wants to or not." And you say, "There are many points of continuity with the early technique, but there are also important novelties and variations." Well, that's a lot to start off with, but why don't you try that?
I can say that here in Europe, we passed through a lot of changes in the psychoanalytic understanding, and that the North American contribution to our theory and technique was remarkable. In fact, we passed from studying the patient to studying the relation between the analyst and the patient and vice versa. And we now have a much more complex vision of the analytic work, theory, and technique. there is at the beginning of psychoanalysis such a positivistic, almost entomological way of looking at the patient as an object in itself, that now we changed. And the international and interregional interchange were absolutely fundamental for this evolution of all of us. So I would say that today, when we dialogue with colleagues coming from other schools and countries, we are much more open and much more inclined to receive, to elaborate, to work through, and finally to include in our vision the foreign contributions.
Well, just to push that point, let me jump to a question that Luca asked you, and he wrote, the taboo of the early years of the last century in psychoanalysis was sexuality. And what do you think is the taboo today? And you answer, the internal dialectics of individuals with their ego ideal, the psychic instance that tells us how we would like or should be. The biggest fear is not being okay, not living up to it, not being lovable, admirable, even enviable. Today, the ideal role model may be a beautiful actor or actress, a highly successful figure, the trumpeter, the billionaire, sportsman, the influencer, and so on. These are figures with a high rate of aestheticism and narcissistic enhancement. And you add, for goodness sake, they're also bearers of qualities that have their own value, mind you. They should not be denigrated in a moralistic manner. However, they are in danger of becoming structuring cliches and of imposing ironclad parameters of evaluation. And you sort of summarize later by saying, guilt has been replaced by shame, the experiences of inferiority, unworthiness, and inadequacy. The moral character of the superego, once the natural enemy of psychoanalysis, is now less strong. Instead, the ego ideal has become overwhelmingly and pervasive, the real master of the stage. And I would draw your attention to your word of the stage, because one hears a lot, especially from younger patients, this idea of being performative, that they have a sense that they're on stage and they're always trying to relate to what they imagine others see about them, as opposed to having an inner awareness of what their experience is. But tell us more about the ego ideal as contrasted with the superego as you see it.
Yes, one could say that the opinion and the evaluation by the others is now much more extended also to a horizontal level and dimension, no more from upstairs, or not only from upstairs like it was mainly in the past. Today, the surrounding environmental opinion, what will the others think of me? Am I okay? Am I performing? Am I admirable? And so on. Which is my narcissistic budget? Which is my position in the range? Is much more important than am I a good person? Am I a good boy? Am I a valuable person for moral reasons? No, it's much more an aesthetic which is dominating the contemporaneity.
Let me nudge you a little bit on this, because certainly I, and I think many of our listeners, are familiar with patients who have a sense of their body as how it appears, as opposed to the carrier of desire and all the conflicts about that. And yet, it's been my experience that in an analysis that goes far enough, after one helps someone get beyond their preoccupation with how they appear in their mirror, either a literal mirror or a mentalized mirror, what you do find is that they are conflicted about their sexuality and their aggressive feelings. And there are forbiddennesses that keep them feeling quite guilty. So guilty, in fact, that they give up the whole object-related enterprise and instead spend time on the shame focus and the grandiosity as opposed to the desire space. Does that match anything that makes sense to you?
Yes, for sure. Guilt didn't disappear.
Right.
It's there. And it could be substituted by shame and by narcissistic worries, also in order to cover some underlying guilt. What changed, in my opinion, in comparison to the time when I started working almost 50 years ago, is the proportion between the two areas. Mm-hmm. I could say, in a very simple way, I hope not simplistic, that when I started working, the patients were threatened more from upstairs. And now they are threatened from everywhere around them. The level, the vertical level is now less influential. Of course, it remains. If there are important family issues, also guilt or rage or unacceptable sexual drives, play their role. Of course, it's fundamental. But the narcissistic issue today may be also, as you suggest, for covering the other side of the issue, is enormously expanded and extended.
And you put forward two theories about why you see the proportion changing to the narcissistic focus. The second of the two theories, just to jump to that, is the absence of a large and dependable family support structure. You mentioned grandparents in particular, how vital they can be to sustain a growing sense of self and a foundational community. And in our prior conversation, you shared with us how fortunate you were to grow up in an extended family that really held you in a very important way. The other point you make, and let me read what you say. You write, "I know that I'm going to touch on delicate situations, one that is most mothers today are working, which is fine from 1,000 points of view. The crucial step, however, is the length of time spent with the child before going back to work, because contractually, many of them have to go back too early, and the symbiotic physiological function with the little one is broken very early." You go on to describe that the infant in the beginning is totally dependent on maternal care and on intense fusional psychic and bodily contact, which allows it to maintain for some time continuity with the intrauterine fetal condition. This high level of fusionality naturally decreases as the weeks and months go by. It is what I like to call a soft landing, a process that must be gradual to succeed best. If the initial physiological fusionality is interrupted too soon or too abruptly, this can disrupt the integration of the forming subject, and the first effect may be that of a partial defensive withdrawal of affective investment in the mother object, with a narcissistic retreat of the infant back unto itself. This is quite both an observation about life today and a powerful hypothesis about its impact as it shows up years later in our office. Can you tell us more about it?
Yes. My observations have been stimulated by the increase of resistances we impact when proposing today an analysis to many patients, while in the past such proposal had been welcomed with much less difficulties. And it seems that sometimes many patients who could be able to afford the engagements, the expenses, concretely, practically, of an analysis, almost surprised and so offended by this proposal, not because this would imply a sort of evaluation of madness, like in the past it was the fantasy, but because they should imagine themselves dependent. What do you expect, doctor, that I depend on you for many times in the week, for a long period of my life, for years maybe? I don't want to depend on anyone. And this fantasy of depending is something which is devaluating, which is also terrifying, has to be connected with some early vicissitudes which made the relationship between the infant and its environment and the objects more difficult. In my opinion, the shortness of the fusional period because of professional job engagements by the mother is one of the issues, but is not the only one. For instance, the lack of the constants of the environment, the absence of other family figures, and the substitution of them, I mean substitution of grandparents or other relatives around, the substitution with a babysitter, who are today typically a rotating class of figures. They change because of their life events and changes. Makes, in my opinion, the infant less inclined to implant a stable investment on the relation, and some habit to withdraw, what I call the barycenter, the central point of investment between the two, between the subject and the object. Because the object is very poorly present, can disappear, and it doesn't deserve a stable investment.
The way you wrote this in the book, you said, unlike 40 years ago, proposing to a patient 4 weekly sessions right away very often means today that the patient will flee or say no. Patients often say, I can go up 1 or 2, and this, which is always justified with reasons, and you say, for pity's sake, sometimes plausible, on the concrete, economical, and or organizational level, in my opinion, originates from deeper roots, which are precisely what we are talking about. The phrase in which I condense this phenomena is, oh, object, thou shalt not have me. I will put, yes, 1 foot in the pool, but not 2. I will not surrender myself to you. I want to keep control of myself. We should honor the fact that surrender is a complicated word and experience, needless to say, and that those who all too ready, quote, surrender, are no more invested in the analytic process than those who say, I'll only come once a week. It's just a different form of not investing, to which you might, and quite reasonably, say, yes, of course it is that, but at least if they're coming, it gives us a chance to unpack that. Whereas if the person's compromise formation of closeness and distance is in the form of once a week, it makes it much more difficult. Do I speak for you reasonably?
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, many analyses become analyses after a while, when the patient, after having started in a self-reassuring, reduced formula, that is like once or twice per week, can finally trust the analyst and the analytic situation, And this is a transforming passage that is much deeper than people suppose. It means a change in the objectal, deep objectal relations. It's a sign and a way at the same time. And notice that all these difficulties I am referring to the analytic start are exactly the same the subject creates and meets in the daily life, in his or her relationships outside analysis, in the love affairs, in the love relations, and there is a much more structured caution today, and sometimes mistrust.
Which touches upon, which I will touch on only very lightly, not to engage in what is a full-throated issue, but the issue of how often one needs to meet to have that full analytic experience. And I can speak for one of the institutes I belong to, where we're finding that if you allow people to start at their own tempo, and if you help them see that they themselves would like to have a greater intensity, because perhaps, like you say, they have discovered the capacity to trust, then they naturally on their own increase to an analytic frequency of 4 or 5, but not if you insist upon it from day one. So that sort of borrows on what you're saying.
Yes, we realize this reality, I would say commonly. If we are so resolute, in spite of the hesitations of the patient, we lose many patients who should be included in the analytic field step by step. In other cases, we still find people who are so aware about their need, about their desire for being welcomed and cared of by the analyst, that there is no problem. But the number of people who initially are so mistrusting, hesitant, afraid, is, in my view, increasing. And this is the reason for I started investigating about the roots of this new contemporaneity.
You know, Stefano, there are many brief comments throughout the book that caught my eye and we could speak of. I want to draw your attention to one of them, and it's just about 4 sentences you wrote, but I think they're worthy of spending a moment on. You write, describing 2 different types of patients. You say, there are people who cannot stand on their own feet and instead, with the help of an analyst, can lead a livable life. I'll say that again. With the help of an analyst, can lead a livable life. When on the other hand, we are talking about neuroses or personality disorders or narcissistic pathologies, there the therapeutic work site has different goals than the maintenance and management of compensated situation. There it is a matter of permanently modifying internal defense devices that turn out to be counterproductive or of maturing in a more dynamic and convenient way underdeveloped parts, not only containing but arriving at a new internal balance, new internal context, and an enrichment of the self. Now, one could easily just read them quickly and not pause, but what you're saying is not only important, but puts words to what many of us in the field have long known, but tend not to speak of and certainly not write about. And that is the patients who are with us for very long times, sometimes for lifetimes. And as you say, with the help of an analyst can lead a livable life, meaning that one is not engaging in the usual analytic process of trying to bring meaning to their life or helping them see what leads them to withhold their meanings or their self, but your presence, it's sort of loosely called supportive treatment. It's not a very good term, but I think people know what I mean. And that you say, and I certainly agree, is honorable work and helps people live their lives. And you, I guess, given your seniority, are comfortable putting that on paper saying, yes, we do this. And yes, we should honor the fact that we do this and people's lives are better because of it. The problem with it, the challenge for us, is that when candidates end up with patients of this type on the couch, and through no fault of anybody, but by virtue of the character of the patient, is unable to help the candidate analyst learn the process of treating neurotic style patients, then we have a challenge, because the candidate quite reasonably would like credit for what can be a long treatment, but then the institute can hesitate reasonably because it hasn't really taught them one of the types of things they're in the institute to learn about.
Yes. Well, this is a complex institutional issue, besides the clinical evidence of the variety of so many different kind of patients. In fact, we know that there are patients with whom a long support or holding is the needed help. What they can afford and can develop at least for a long time, while in other cases, treating some other patients like if they were of this kind while they are not could be an error, could be a mistake clinically and theoretically. So the capacity of the couple, candidate and supervisor, to understand session by session the profile, the features, the possibilities of the patient. Also, keeping an open door for possible unexpected events, clinical events, advancements of the patient, and so on. But the capacity of them, of this couple, to realize, to know better, and in some cases to accept the clinical evidence of these limits, of these possibilities, is an important passage in the analytic education. We could expect that also the institutes can understand with the same finesse the clinical reality the candidate is dealing with, for instance, with different patients, and recognizing that with some of them a classical analytic work not only can be done, but should be done, while with others it would be an impossible expectation, and it would force the situation, the clinical situation, beyond the feasibility of that. So we are now receiving so many different patients that having theoretical and clinical flexibility and wide parameters is, of course, necessary. This is also because the classical neurotic patients seem to be decreased in number in many clinical situations, while also serious patients reach our offices. And this implies that we deal with different techniques.
Which leads me to your answer to a question that Luca asked you. He said, what for you is the most precious gift that a good analysis gives? And you write, as so many others before me have already said, there are at least two precious gifts. The first is the recovery of a capacity for good internal contact with oneself. The second, which is related to the first, is the improved ability to relate to the other. These two go together. You do not have a good relationship with the other if you do not have a good enough relationship with yourself, and vice versa. Analysis, when it works well, or at least well enough, allows this resumption of good contact. It supposes that after a sufficiently successful analysis, not only does a person know himself better, but he understands better many aspects of his own way of being and relating to others. Of course, the knowledge factor is very important. The central ego becomes more aware, but the change does not consist only in this. There is also a better ability to live with and contact with self and others that goes beyond the cognitive factor. Now, I think many people listening to that would be shaking their head and saying, yes, that makes, I agree with that, that makes sense. And then you add something and you say, by the way, it is not just about recovering something that has been lost. Sometimes it is really about creating from scratch something that was never there. Now, that's a statement of a different order. Why don't you help me with that?
Yes, among the many possible changes that psychoanalysis can promote and facilitate, we today are much more open to the first to a different evaluation of the collateral transferences, for instance. Classically, they had been interpreted as defensive shifts, while today we are much more complex in examining them. We consider, we make a distinction between defense, which is in many cases there and is the main evidence, or in other cases, we evaluated if our patient is trying or is naturally inclined to extend out of the analysis some new skill, some new possibility in the relation with other objects and figures. On the other hand, for instance, when we have to reconstruct a possible lacking object or role or function, we can see that if the analyst in itself has been able, and the patient allowing him to be able to enter to a deep level the objectal reality of the internal world of the patient, it can happen that some new function or position can be installed, can be achieved. And this is something that could be rare, in fact. But it happens. And this is one more reason for not blaming the length of some analysis, some analytic treatments, because time is needed for reaching, for entering that internal deep area where the analytic relation can create something new. Transformation is also one of the words that in our analytic world became more and more common and utilized fruitfully, because we have achieved the certainty that there can be a transformation, not only an understanding or a clarification, but also a transformation of the quality of the objectal world and of the relation with it. So I think it is legitimate today to think, or not to exclude a priori, the fact that the patient can construct with the analyst, can build up something new inside, thanks to the channels that convey something from the interior of the analyst to that of the patient and vice versa.
That's beautifully put. Let me return to your car wash. In your book, you describe you dropped your car off at a car wash, and you took a walk around the neighborhood. And you say you were surprised by the enormous number of places dedicated to personal care. There are hairdressers and gyms and pharmacies and tattoo parlors and stores for nail care and mobile phone repairers. And you conjectured and you reflected on it and you said, this makes me think of an overall withdrawal of libido about oneself and one's body, most likely replacing a similar share of object investments. And you go on to say, as we've been saying today, the center of gravity today is somewhat withdrawn towards the subject in a narcissistic form. There is an increased care for one's bodily self, which would not be a bad thing if it were not because of its unexpected proportions, the possible sign of a certain withdrawal from the positive relational tension towards the object, the other than oneself. You know, it's striking for me to read this after what you just said about, you know, the deep analytic connection and immersion and how that can offer such a profound evolution, if not revolution, in the life of the patient, not to mention what it can offer the analyst, who is also a participant in this process. And here, in contrast, we're speaking about tattoo parlors and gyms, which, not to say there's anything wrong with either of those, but your point is that the proportion of investment is what you're noticing in the community and in the office.
Yes. This is an observation which is, at least in our country, but I saw that also in others, is very common. There has been a decrease of the shops regarding objects for the home, furnitures, all what is needed for receiving guests, for making the home more attractive, or also elegant and so on, is the person, the body of the person, or the empowerment of the capacities of the person. For instance, objects who strengthen the power of the person. While other more relational objects are less interesting for the majority of customers. So there should be a confirmation, in my view, about this withdrawal of the investment on the body, on the appearance, on the look, and on the empowerment of some skills of the individual for himself or herself.
Which you link as well to the whole notion of responsibility. Responsibility is that function that involves attention to, if not caretaking, towards others. And you mentioned that it is perhaps a rare person who can combine the capacity to be both playful and also responsible.
Exactly. This is the ideal. Our ideal is a completeness, a good, well-integrated summary of good capacities, both regarding the individual investment and the relational area. Yes.
I want to read one really delightful exchange that you and Luca had that makes me smile every time I read it. He asks you, there is such a richness of the present that even planning is of little interest. On the other hand, if one wants to remain a boy forever, the future is of no interest. Life is now. I ask you, what does this timeless man do? And your answer, and I could picture your answering with a twinkle in your eye, you answer, he makes great aperitifs, many aperitifs. We are in the civilization of Prosecco, which you are quick to add, in parentheses, which is very pleasant, by the way, Prosecco and appetizers. The aperitif, as a social ceremony, has the characteristic of being quite exciting, with bubbly, and of not being very demanding. You don't sit in a specific place next to two or three people who would then be the ones you would necessarily have to talk to during the evening, in the case of dinner. But you keep yourself floating even from the point of view of contacts. The aperitif promises much and keeps all possible options open.
Yes, I confirm. This is a very, this is a sign of our era. people don't want to feel linked, to feel placed in a stable position and with those specific people. They want to feel free to float. This is not only the organizational structure of these social meetings. This is the equivalent of a much larger and meaningful relational and mental organization, which today is kept as the fundamental by many individuals who don't want to build up something limited, stable, and of course, responsible. So today we know one has spoken about a liquid society. It's a definition that that was very well focusing on this aspect. And I think that this is a problem for the children, and particularly for those very little children from the infancy on, which should rely on a stable world of figures and of relations.
Let me return us to the clinical setting, because you and your book have described beautifully the nature of the clinical condition, less so about the challenge of how we can be of help. And you write, describing these different types of patients, you say, with a traumatically shaken, poorly integrated patient, we can even say decompensated patient, we pretend to provide a non-maternal relational environment and care from the start, without a focus on central ego functioning or recovery of the state of the self. And in my opinion, it is not a question of being a mamo or not, but of recognizing what is actually needed. If it is a person who is still far behind in growth, some restraining and nurturing functions are necessary. In short, a proper caring relationship should form and organize itself according to the specific needs of the person with whom and for whom we are working. Otherwise, it will end up precisely selling everyone the same wine. An analyst, therefore, should have diverse theories, internal arrangements, and technical tools. Again, that's a very rich series of comments. As you and I have spoken about this beforehand, there's an issue of translation here. You wrote originally in Italian, and this was translated into, we pretend to provide a non-maternal relational environment. And you didn't mean pretend.
Exactly.
So why don't we clarify that for the record? What do you mean to say?
I wanted to mean, and I admit I was wrong, I didn't check correctly the translation. I meant we expect sometimes. We have a too strong expectation that it should happen. Pretend in Italian is a false friend, because in Italian it means pretendere, means having a wrong expectation or a fierce expectation, too strong. I know that in English it means something else, of course. But,
So what is it? How do you approach the, as you call, poorly integrated, traumatically shaken patient, perhaps one who was abandoned at a very young age to an institution, and they come to our office in pain of various sorts or struggles? What is your approach? How are you, what do you bring of yourself that's different?
The model I have in mind it corresponds to an early experience in my medical education. When I had, like all doctors in Italy, I had a period in, we name it pronto soccorso, which means when in a hospital a traumatized person arrives, and traumatized, bodily traumatized, after an accident or something like that, and it goes into the first unit. I don't know the name, in first help, first evaluation place. And the first recommendation for the doctors is first to realize what is there, to understand which is the condition of that person. It could be a severely traumatized post-accident patient, or it could be, for instance, a less serious case. But the first step is to have a good picture, a quite clear idea about the condition of the patient. If the analyst follows only his or her theoretical main views or is transferentially connected to a school which is not so interested in that pathology, it could lack of examining carefully that patient. We have to realize if something interiorly is broken, if something in the skin, in the skin of the patient, metaphorically speaking, is wounded. If there is something that we have to discover by taking away the clothes of the patient with delicacy, but with the capacity to look the patient as he or she is really. This is so obvious that sometimes is not considered because we are so close to the elephant that we don't see the elephant. And we have to have an increasing idea about the needs, the fears, the obstacles, the traumas, all the most serious impediments and more needy areas of a patient. Then we will be able to follow more some criteria, some ideas, some concepts, and so on. But first we have to understand clearly what we are dealing with and how that patient is organized or disorganized.
Before we close, I want to ask you about the issue of sexuality, which is also, speaking of changing times, we live in changing times with notions of sexuality. And you write in the book, "For the IPA, I just participated in a selection of papers on the topic of gender diversities, and I found studies of an extraordinary quality, both on homosexuality, transsexuality, and all the developments, processes, evolutions that human sexuality, in a general sense, can know. The concept of perversion is not lost, but it should be individuated and limited to a set of characteristics and links in which the quality of object relations is unhealthy." You go on to say, "Conversely, the profound naturalness of certain developments can be recognized precisely by the good quality of the object relationship. From this point of view, there has been an evolution, first of all scientific of enormous importance, broadening of horizons, and also of different institutional organizations. However, this does not mean accepting everything as valid and sound, because we have become much more competent in recognizing and evaluating precisely relational quality." Want to comment on that?
Yes. When I was president of the IPA, I created the Committee on Gender Diversities. It was the right time, because culturally, socially, and also psychologically, there were so important changes that it was mandatory to invite psychoanalysts to go more to depth and more to an extended view on that area. What I asked the committee for, and I know the committee was able and still is able to go on with these recommendations, was to keep in every case an open-minded position, but also a scientific point of view. And when some years after I had the opportunity to read these wonderful papers, I felt moved, realizing how this area is now much more studied, understood, and treated by the analyst than in the past. There are so many clinical and theoretical questions to be afforded that much work has to be done. For instance, when we receive a patient that has a strong sexual characterization, it could be heterosexual, homosexual, or transsexual, for instance, we could consider, reflect carefully, and know better whether some positions, some relational and sexual positions, are more defensive or more natural. If they are from the beginning of the life, from a further fixation or for a defensive reaction, and which is the economy of this position in the life of the patient. This is important in order to have a more human idea about each possible story and evolution of the individual. But this implies also a scientific mentality joined to an open-minded position, which is happening in our clinical and theoretical world.
I want to close with asking you to read the final paragraphs of your book. And to introduce it, it's about the subject of sustainability. And you say that the word sustainable applies not only to ecology, economics, and politics, but also to psychoanalysis and what we psychoanalysts can actually offer, do, support, ask for, and will be crucial in our work in the future. And for the rest of the paragraph, let me ask you to read it, and then I'm going to ask you some questions about it. It's beginning where it says, "This is the old schema."
This is the old schema that Dr. Molinari taught me, which was very simple and said that the central ego can ask itself, what do I wish to do? What can I do? What do I need to do? Combined, these three questions can lead to what do I want to do, which is not the simple desire, but what I consciously and responsibly decide after exploring and weighing the dimensions of the ideal, the ought, and the possible. It is a grid that remains most interesting because it brings together the different sides of psychopathology, the problem of neurosis in those who do not know what they wish for, the aspects of psychosis in those who do not know what they can realistically do, because they cultivate omnipotence, and the potential aspects of perversion in those who do not respect what they have to do. The person sufficiently capable of thinking eventually decides, based on these three parameters, what his will and hopefully the course of his action will be. I believe that psychoanalysis in the future will come to terms with what it wants, what it can, and what it must do. So it will have to balance the ideal with the mandate of duty and the recognition of limits and possibilities. A blow to our residual, unconfessed, omnipotent ambitions. A bitter pill to swallow, but also a decidedly healthy dietary measure.
That's beautifully put, and it's a lovely way both to end the book and end our conversation. But as you and I have discussed prior to this conversation, there's more to it, and that is you bring forward at the end of your book, Dr. Molinari. And you have mentioned earlier in the book that Dr. Molinari was your psychoanalyst. And I was touched and found of interest that he is present with you not that it's an odd thing that one's analyst, even after many, many decades, is present with one, but that you maybe dedicate the book to him. That may be too strong. Let me invite you to share your reflections on that, because when we spoke about it, you hadn't realized that he was in the last paragraph.
You sharply noticed this detail that I started and I finished by mentioning Dr. Molinari. Dr. Molinari, my analyst, was an old analyst coming from Hungary, and he was a man who was able to, I can say in a humble way, to change my life. And gratitude to him, my esteem, and my affectionate memory made me unconsciously place him at the beginning and at the end of my book. And I thank you for having noticed this and for having me made me more aware about this.
Well, you're welcome. It's always nice to be reminded. When we spoke about it, you said you think of him as your father and grandfather, and you said it in as warm a way as you're saying it now, so that clearly comes across. But quite genuinely, the thanks for me goes both ways, because, you know, you talk about evaluating a patient and not missing the elephant in the room and really determining who the patient is and what the patient needs and providing as best one can the truth for that patient and the truth of the relationship that the two of you can establish. And I can't imagine a better message or more important message for candidates, for patients, for analysts, for institutes, that is to always try to be listening to whatever the truth of the patient is. And it's not obviously necessarily the manifest truth, but the latent truth, which can lead us down all kinds of paths. And your work over the many, many decades has indicated your openness to travel whatever the path is of where you think you can make that better difference, like the good doctor you started out being and are today. So thank you. The name of the book is Freud and the Changing World, Contemporary Psychoanalysis and Its Troubles. I don't hear the book so much about its troubles. I hear it about its challenges and opportunities, but I understand your spirit. Stefano, it's been a pleasure again, and thank you for sharing your thoughts.
Thank you for having worked together this way, this nice and thoughtful way. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.